When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly, but then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Chapter 11 of The Inimitable Jeeves. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. The Inimitable Jeeves by P.G. Woodhouse. Chapter 11. Comrade Bingo. The thing really started in the park, at the Marble Arch end, where weird birds of every description collect on Sunday afternoons and stand on soapboxes and make speeches. It isn't often you'll find me there, but it so happened that on the Sabbath after my return to the good old Matrop, I had a call to pay in Manchester Square, and taking a stroll round in that direction so as not to arrive too early, I found myself right in the middle of it. Now that the Empire isn't the place it was, I always think the park on a Sunday is the centre of London, if you know what I mean. I mean to say, that's the spot that makes the returned exile really sure he's back again. After what you might call my enforced sojourn in New York, I'm bound to say that I stood there fairly lapping it all up. It did me good to listen to the lads giving tongue and realize that all had ended happily and Bertram was home again. On the edge of the mob farthest away from me, a gang of top-hatted chappies were starting an open-air missionary service. Near at hand, an atheist was letting himself go with a good deal of vim, though handicapped a bit by having no roof to his mouth. While in front of me there stood a little group of serious thinkers with a banner labeled Heralds of the Red Dawn, and as I came up, one of the heralds, a bearded egg in a slouch hat and a tweed suit, was slimming it into the idle rich with such breath and vigor that I paused for a moment to get an earful. While I was standing there, somebody spoke to me. "Mr. Wooster, surely." Stout chappie. Couldn't place him for a second. Then I got him. Bingo Little's uncle, the one I had lunch with at the time when young Bingo was in love with that waitress at the Piccadilly Bun Shop. No wonder I hadn't recognized him at first. When I had seen him last, he had been a rather sloppy old gentleman, coming down to lunch, I remember, in carpet slippers and a velvet smoking jacket. Whereas now dapper simply wasn't the word. He absolutely gleamed in the sunlight in a silk hat, morning coat, lavender spats, and sponge-bag trousers, as now worn. Dressy to a degree. "Oh, hello," I said. "Going strong?"
"I am in excellent health, thank you. And you?"
"In the pink. Just been over to America."
"Ah, collecting local color for one of your delightful romances?"
"Eh?" I had to think a bit before I got on to what he meant. Then I remembered the Rosie M. Banks business. "Oh, no," I said, "just felt I needed a change." "Seen anything of Bingo lately?" I asked quickly, being desirous of heading the old thing off what you might call the literary side of my life.
"Bingo?"
"Your nephew."
"Oh, Richard. No, not very recently. Since my marriage, a little coolness seems to have sprung up."
"Sorry to hear that. So you've married since I saw you, what? Mrs. Little all right?"
"My wife is happily robust. But, not Mrs. Little. Since we last met, a gracious sovereign has been pleased to bestow on me a signal mark of his favour in the shape of, a peerage. On the publication of the last honours list, I became Lord Bittlesham."
"By Jove! Really? I say heartiest congratulations. That's the stuff to give the troops, what?"
"Lord Bittlesham?" I said. "Why, you're the owner of Ocean Breeze." "Yes. Marriage has enlarged my horizon in many directions. My wife is interested in horse racing, and I now maintain a small stable. I understand that Ocean Breeze is fancied, as I am told the expression is, for a race which will take place at the end of the month at Goodwood, the Duke of Richmond's seat in Sussex. The Goodwood Cup, rather. I've got my chemise on it for one. Indeed. Well, I trust the animal will justify your confidence. I know little of these matters myself, but my wife tells me that it is regarded in knowledgeable circles as what I believe is termed a snip. At this moment I suddenly noticed that the audience was gazing in our direction with a good deal of interest, and I saw that the bearded chappie was pointing at us. "Yes, look at them! Drink them in!" he was yelling, his voice rising above the perpetual motion fellows and beating the missionary service all to nothing. "There you see two typical members of the class which has downtrodden the poor for centuries. Idlers, non-producers. Look at the tall, thin one with the face like a motor mascot. Has he ever done an honest day's work in his life? No. A prowler, a trifler, and a bloodsucker. And I bet he still owes his tailor for those trousers." He seemed to me to be verging on the personal, and I didn't think a lot of it. Old Bittlesham, on the other hand, was pleased and amused. "A great gift of expression these fellows have," he chuckled. "Very trenchant." "And the fat one," proceeded the chappie. "Don't miss him. Do you know who that is? That's Lord Bittlesham, one of the worst. What has he ever done except eat 4 square meals a day? His god is his belly, and he sacrifices burnt offerings to it. If you opened that man now, you would find enough lunch to support 10 working-class families for a week." "You know, that's rather well put," I said, but the old boy didn't seem to see it. He had turned a brightish magenta and was bubbling like a kettle on the boil. "Come away, Mr. Wooster," he said. "I am the last man to oppose the right of free speech, but I refuse to listen to this vulgar abuse any longer." We legged it with quiet dignity, the chappie pursuing us with his foul innuendos to the last. Dashed embarrassing. Next day I looked in at the club and found young Bingo in the smoking room. "Hello, Bingo," I said, toddling over to his corner full of bonhomie, for I was glad to see the chump. "How's the boy?" "Jogging along. I saw your uncle yesterday." Young Bingo unleashed a grin that split his face in half. "I know you did, you trifler. Well, sit down, old thing, and suck a bit of blood. How's the prowling these days?" "Good Lord, you weren't there." "Yes, I was." "I didn't see you." "Yes, you did. But perhaps you didn't recognize me in the shrubbery."
"The shrubbery?"
"The beard, my boy. Worth every penny I paid for it. Defies detection. Of course, it's a nuisance having people shouting beaver at you all the time, but one's got to put up with that." I goggled at him. "I don't understand." "It's a long story. Have a martini or a small Gorin soda, and I'll tell you all about it. Before we start, give me your honest opinion. Isn't she the most wonderful girl you ever saw in your puff?" He had produced a photograph from somewhere, like a conjurer taking a rabbit out of a hat, and was waving it in front of me. It appeared to be a female of sorts, all eyes and teeth.
"Oh, great Scott," I said. "Don't tell me you're in love again."
He seemed aggrieved. "What do you mean, again?" "Well, to my certain knowledge, you've been in love with at least 6 girls since the spring, and it's only July now. There was that waitress, and Honoria Glossop, and—oh, tush, not to say pish. Those girls, mere passing fancies. This is the real thing."
"Where did you meet her?"
"On top of a bus. Her name is Charlotte Corday Robotham."
"My God!
It's not her fault, poor child. Her father had her christened like that because he's all for the revolution, and it seems that the original Charlotte Corday used to go about stabbing oppressors in their baths, which entitles her to consideration and respect. You must meet old Robotham, Bertie, a delightful chap. Wants to massacre the bourgeoisie, sack Park Lane, and disembowel the hereditary aristocracy. Well, nothing could be fairer than that, what? But about Charlotte. we were on top of the bus, and it started to rain. I offered her my umbrella, and we chatted of this and that. I fell in love and got her address, and a couple of days later I bought the beard and toddled round and met the family. But why the beard? Well, she had told me all about her father on the bus, and I saw that to get any footing at all in the home I should have to join these Red Dawn blighters, and naturally, if I was to make speeches in the park, where at any moment I might run into a dozen people I knew, something in the nature of a disguise was indicated. So I bought the beard, and by Jove, old boy, I've become a dashed attached to the thing. When I take it off to come in here, for instance, I feel absolutely nude. It's done me a lot of good with old Robotham. He thinks I'm a Bolshevist of sorts who has to go about disguised because of the police. You really must meet old Robotham, Bertie. I tell you what, are you doing anything tomorrow afternoon? Nothing special, why? Good, then you can have us all to tea at your flat. I had promised to take the crowd to Lyon's Popular Café after a meeting we're holding down in Lambeth, but I can save money this way. And believe me, laddie, nowadays, as far as I'm concerned, a penny saved is a penny earned. My uncle told you he got married? Yes, and he said there was a coolness between you. Coolness? I'm down to zero. Ever since he married, he's been launching out in every direction and economizing on me. I suppose that peerage cost the old devil the deuce of a sum. Even baronetcies have gone up frightfully nowadays, I'm told. And he started a racing stable. By the way, put your last collar stud on Ocean Breeze for the Goodwood Cup. It's a cert. I'm going to. It can't lose. I mean to win enough on it to marry Charlotte with. You're going to Goodwood, of course. Rather. So are we. We're holding a meeting on Cup Day just outside the paddock. But I say, aren't you taking frightful risks? Your uncle's sure to be at Goodwood. Suppose he spots you. He'll be fed to the gills if he finds out that you're the fellow who ragged him in the park. How the deuce is he to find out? Use your intelligence, you prowling inhaler of red corpuscles. If he didn't spot me yesterday, why should he spot me at Goodwood? Well, thanks for your cordial invitation for tomorrow, old thing. We shall be delighted to accept. Do us well, laddie, and blessing shall reward you. By the way, I may have misled you by using the word tea. None of your wafer slices of bread and butter. We're good trenchermen, we of the Revolution. What we shall require will be something on the order of scrambled eggs, muffins, jam, ham, cake, and sardines. Expect us at 5 sharp. But I say, I'm not quite sure. Yes, you are. Silly ass, don't you see that this is going to do you a bit of good when the Revolution breaks loose? When you see old Robotham sprinting up Piccadilly with a dripping knife in each hand, you'll be jolly thankful to be able to remind him that he once ate your tea and shrimps. There will be 4 of us, Charlotte, Seraph, the old man, and Comrade Butt. I suppose he will insist on coming along. Who the devil's Comrade Butt? Did you notice a fellow standing on my left in our little troop yesterday? Small, shriveled chap, looks like a haddock with lung trouble. That's Butt. My rival, dash him. He's sort of semi-engaged to Charlotte at the moment. Till I came along, he was the blue-eyed boy. He's got a voice like a foghorn, and old Robotham thinks a lot of him. But hang it, if I can't thoroughly encompass this Butt and cut him out and put him where he belongs among the discards, well, I'm not the man I was, that's all. He may have a big voice, but he hasn't my gift of expression. Thank heaven I was once cox of my college boat. Well, I must be pushing now. I say, you don't know how I could raise 50 quid somehow, do you? Why don't you work? Work? Said young Bingo, surprised. What, me? No, I shall have to think of some way. I must put at least 50 on Ocean Breeze. Well, see you tomorrow. God bless you, old sort, and don't forget the muffins. I don't know why, ever since I first knew him at school, I should have felt a rummy feeling of responsibility for young Bingo. I mean to say, he's not my son, thank goodness, or my brother, or anything like that. He's got absolutely no claim on me at all, and yet a large-sized chunk of my existence seems to be spent in fussing over him like a bally old hen and hauling him out of the soup. I suppose it must be some rare beauty in my nature or something. At any rate, this latest affair of his worried me. He seemed to be doing his best to marry into a family of pronounced loonies, and how the deuce he thought he was going to support even a mentally afflicted wife on nothing a year beat me. Old Bittlesham was bound to knock off his allowance if he did anything of the sort, and with a fellow like young Bingo, if you knocked off his allowance, you might just as well hit him on the head with an axe and make a clean job of it. "Jeeves," I said when I got home, "I'm worried."
"Sir?"
"About Mr. Little. I won't tell you about it now, because he's bringing some friends of his to tea tomorrow, and then you will be able to judge for yourself. I want you to observe closely, Jeeves, and form your decision."
"Very good, sir."
"And about the tea. Get in some muffins."
"Yes, sir."
"And some jam, ham, cake, scrambled eggs, and 5 or 6 wagon loads of sardines."
"Sardines, sir?" said Jeeves with a shudder.
"Sardines." There was an awkward pause. "Don't blame me, Jeeves," I said. "It isn't my fault."
"No, sir."
"Well, that's that."
"Yes, sir."
I could see the man was brooding tensely. I found, as a general rule in life, that the things you think are going to be the scariest nearly always turn out not so bad after all. But it wasn't that way with Bingo's tea party. From the moment he invited himself, I felt that the thing was going to be blue round the edges, and it was. And I think the most gruesome part of the whole affair was the fact that, for the first time since I'd known him, I saw Jeeves come very near to being rattled. I suppose there's a chink in everyone's armor, and young Bingo found Jeeves's right at the drop of the flag, when he breezed in with 6 inches or so of brown beard hanging onto his chin. I had forgotten to warn Jeeves about the beard, and it came on him absolutely out of a blue sky. I saw the man's jaw drop, and he clutched at the table for support. I don't blame him, mind you. Few people have ever looked fouler than young Bingo in the fungus. Jeeves paled a little. Then the weakness passed, and he was himself again. But I could see that he had been shaken. Young Bingo was too busy introducing the mob to take much notice. They were a very C3 collection. Comrade Butt looked like one of the things that come out of dead trees after the rain. Moth-eaten was the word I should have used to describe old Robotham, and as for Charlotte, she seemed to take me straight into another and a dreadful world. It wasn't that she was exactly bad-looking. In fact, if she had knocked off starchy foods and done Swedish exercises for a bit, she might have been quite tolerable. But there was too much of her. Billowy curves. Well-nourished, perhaps, expresses it best. And while she may have had a heart of gold, the thing you noticed about her first was that she had a tooth of gold. I knew that young Bingo, when in form, could fall in love with practically anything of the other sex. But this time I couldn't see any excuse for him at all. "My friend Mr. Wooster," said Bingo, completing the ceremonial. Old Robotham looked at me, and then he looked round the room, and I could see he wasn't particularly braced. There's nothing of absolutely oriental luxury about the old flat, but I have managed to make myself fairly comfortable, and I suppose the surroundings jarred him a bit. "Mr. Wooster," said old Robotham. "May I say Comrade Wooster?"
"I beg your pardon?"
"Are you of the movement?"
"Well, do you yearn for the revolution?"
"Well, I don't know that I exactly yearn. I mean to say, as far as I can make out, the whole hub of the scheme seems to be to massacre coves like me, and I don't mind owning I'm not frightfully keen on the idea." "But I'm talking him round," said Bingo. "I'm wrestling with him. A few more treatments ought to do the trick." Old Robotham looked at me a bit doubtfully. "Comrade Little has great eloquence," he admitted. "I think he talks something wonderful," said the girl, and young Bingo shot a glance of such succulent devotion at her that I reeled in my tracks. It seemed to depress Comrade Butt a good deal, too.
He scowled at the carpet and said something about dancing on volcanoes.
"Tea is served, sir," said Jeeves.
"Tea, Pa," said Charlotte,
starting at the word like the old warhorse who hears the bugle, and we got down to it. Funny how one changes as the years roll on. At school, I remember, I would cheerfully have sold my soul for scrambled eggs and sardines at 5 in the afternoon, but somehow, since reaching man's estate, I had rather dropped out of the habit, and I'm bound to admit I was appalled to a goodish extent at the way the sons and daughter of the Revolution shoved their heads down and went for the foodstuffs. Even Comrade Butt cast off his gloom for a space and immersed his whole being in scrambled eggs, only coming to the surface at intervals to grab another cup of tea. Presently the hot water gave out, and I turned to Jeeves. "More hot water."
"Very good, sir."
"Hoy! What's this? What's this?"
Old Robotham had lowered his cup and was eyeing us sternly. He tapped Jeeves on the shoulder.
"No servility, my lad, no servility."
"I beg your pardon, sir?"
"Don't call me sir. Call me comrade. Do you know what you are, my lad? You're an obsolete relic of an exploded feudal system."
"Very good, sir."
"If there's one thing that makes the blood boil in my veins—"
"Have another sardine," chipped in young Bingo, the first sensible thing he'd done since I had known him. Old Robotham took three and dropped the subject, and Jeeves drifted away. I could see by the look of his back what he felt. At last, just as I was beginning to feel that it was going on forever, the thing finished. I woke up to find the party getting ready to leave. Sardines and about 3 quarts of tea had mellowed old Robotham. There was quite a genial look in his eye as he shook my hand.
"I must thank you for your hospitality, Comrade Wooster," he said.
"Oh, not at all. Only too glad."
"Hospitality," snorted the man Butt,
going off in my ear like a depth charge. He was scowling in a morose sort of manner at the young Bingo and the girl, who were giggling together by the window.
"I wonder the food didn't turn to ashes in our mouths. Eggs, muffins, sardines, all wrung from the bleeding lips of the starving poor. Oh, I say, what a beastly idea!"
"I will send you some literature on the subject of the cause," said old Robotham.
"And soon, I hope, we shall see you at one of our little meetings."
Jeeves came in to clear away, and found me sitting among the ruins. It was all very well for Comrade Butt to knock the food, but he had pretty well finished the ham, and if you had shoved the remainder of the jam into the bleeding lips of the starving poor, it would hardly have made them sticky.
"Well, Jeeves," I said, "how about it?"
"I would prefer to express no opinion, sir."
"Jeeves, Mr. Little is in love with that female."
"So I gathered, sir.
She was slapping him in the passage."
I clutched my brow.
"Slapping him?"
"Yes, sir, roguishly."
"Great Scott! I didn't know it had got as far as that. How did Comrade Butt seem to be taking it? Or perhaps he didn't see?"
"Yes, sir, he observed the entire proceedings. He struck me as extremely jealous."
"I don't blame him. Jeeves, what are we to do?"
"I could not say, sir."
"It's a bit thick."
"Very much so, sir."
And that was all the consolation I got from Jeeves. End of chapter 11. Chapter 12 of The Inimitable Jeeves. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. The Inimitable Jeeves by P. G. Woodhouse. Chapter 12. Bingo Has a Bad Goodwood. I had promised to meet young Bingo next day, to tell him what I thought of his infernal Charlotte, and I was mooching slowly up St. James's Street, trying to think how the dickens I could explain to him, without hurting his feelings, that I considered her one of the world's foulest, when who should come toddling out of the Devonshire Club but old Biddlesham and Bingo himself. I hurried on and overtook them. "What ho!" I said. The result of this simple greeting was a bit of a shock. Old Biddlesham quivered from head to foot like a poleaxed blancmange.
His eyes were popping, and his face had gone sort of greenish.
"Mr. Wooster."
He seemed to recover somewhat, as if I wasn't the worst thing that could have happened to him.
"You gave me a severe start."
"Oh, sorry."
"My uncle," said young Bingo in a hushed, bedside sort of voice, "isn't feeling quite himself this morning. He's had a threatening letter."
"I go in fear of my life," said old Bittlesham.
"Threatening letter?"
"Written," said old Bittlesham, "in an uneducated hand and couched in terms of uncompromising menace. Mr. Wooster, do you recall a sinister bearded man who assailed me in no measured terms in Hyde Park last Sunday?"
I jumped and shot a look at young Bingo. The only expression on his face was one of grave, kindly concern.
"Why, yes," I said. "Bearded man. Chap with a beard."
"Could you identify him if necessary?"
"Well, I, how do you mean?"
"The fact is, Bertie," said Bingo, "we think this man with the beard is at the bottom of all this business. I happened to be walking late last night through Pounceby Gardens, where Uncle Mortimer lives, and as I was passing the house a fellow came hurrying down the steps in a furtive sort of way. Probably he had just been shoving the letter in at the front door. I noticed that he had a beard. I didn't think any more of it, however, until this morning, when Uncle Mortimer showed me the letter he had received and told me about the chap in the park. I'm going to make inquiries."
"The police should be informed," said Lord Bittlesham.
"No," said young Bingo firmly, "not at this stage of the proceedings. It would hamper me. Don't you worry, Uncle. I think I can track this fellow down. You leave it all to me. I'll pop you into a taxi now and go and talk it over with Bertie."
"You're a good boy, Richard," said old Bittlesham,
and we put him in a passing cab and pushed off.
I turned and looked young Bingo squarely in the eyeball.
"Did you send that letter?" I said.
"Rather. You ought to have seen it, Bertie. One of the best gent's ordinary threatening letters I ever wrote."
"But where's the sense of it?"
"Bertie, my lad," said Bingo, taking me earnestly by the coat sleeve, "I had an excellent reason. Posterity may say of me what it will, but one thing it can never say, that I have not a good solid business head. Look here." He waved a bit of paper in front of my eyes.
Great Scott! It was a check, an absolute dash check for 50 of the best, signed Bittlesham and made out to the order of R. Little.
"What's that for?"
"Expenses," said Bingo, pouching it.
"You don't suppose an investigation like this can be carried on for nothing, do you? I now proceed to the bank and startle them into a fit with it. Later, I edge round to my bookie and put the entire sum on Ocean Breeze. What you want in situations of this kind, Bertie, is tact. If I had gone to my uncle and asked him for 50 quid, would I have got it? No. But by exercising tact. Oh, by the way, what do you think of Charlotte?"
"Well, young Bingo massaged my sleeve affectionately.
"I know, old man, I know. Don't try to find words. She bowled you over, eh? Left you speechless, what? I know. That's the effect she has on everybody. Well, I leave you here, laddie. Oh, before we part. But. What of but? Nature's worst blunder, don't you think?"
"I must say I've seen cheerier souls."
"I think I've got him licked, Bertie. Charlotte is coming to the zoo with me this afternoon. Alone. And later on to the pictures. That looks like the beginning of the end, what? Well, toodaloo, friend of my youth. If you've nothing better to do this morning, you might take a stroll along Bond Street and be picking out a wedding present."
I lost sight of Bingo after that. I left messages a couple of times at the club, asking him to ring me up, but they didn't have any effect. I took it that he was too busy to respond. The Sons of the Red Dawn also passed out of my life, though Jeeves told me he had met Comrade Butt one evening and had a brief chat with him. He reported Butt as gloomier than ever. In the competition for the Bulging Charlotte, Butt had apparently gone right back in the betting.
"Mr. Little would appear to have eclipsed him entirely, sir," said Jeeves.
"Bad news, Jeeves, bad news."
"Yes, sir."
"I suppose what it amounts to, Jeeves,
is that when young Bingo really takes his coat off and starts in, there is no power of God or man that can prevent him from making a chump of himself.
It would seem so, sir, said Jeeves.
Then Goodwood came along, and I dug out the best suit and popped down. I never know when I'm telling a story whether to cut the thing down to plain facts or whether to drool on and shove in a lot of atmosphere and all that. I mean, many a cove would no doubt edge into the final spasm of this narrative with a long description of Goodwood, featuring the blue sky, the rolling prospect, the joyous crowds of pickpockets, and the parties of the second part who were having their pockets picked, and, in a word, what not. But better give it a miss, I think. Even if I wanted to go into details about the Bally meeting, I don't think I'd have the heart to. The thing's too recent. The anguish hasn't had time to pass. You see, what happened was that Ocean Breeze, curse him, finished absolutely nowhere for the cup. Believe me, nowhere. These are the times that try men's souls. It's never pleasant to be caught in the machinery when a favorite comes unstitched, and in the case of this particular dashed animal, one had come to look on the running of the race as a pure formality, a sort of quaint old-world ceremony to be gone through before one sauntered up to the bookie and collected. I had wandered out of the paddock to try and forget, when I bumped into old Bittlesham. And he looked so rattled and purple, and his eyes were standing out of his head at such an angle, that I simply pushed my hand out and shook his in silence. "Me too," I said. "Me too. How much did you drop?"
"Drop?
On Ocean Breeze."
"I did not bet on Ocean Breeze."
"What? You own the favorite for the cup and didn't back it?"
"I never bet on horse racing. It is against my principles. I am told that the animal failed to win the contest."
"Failed to win? Why, he was so far behind that he nearly came in first in the next race."
"Tut," said old Bittlesham.
"Tut is right," I agreed. Then the rumminess of the thing struck me. "But if you haven't dropped a parcel over the race," I said, "why are you looking so rattled?"
"That fellow is here."
"What fellow?"
"That bearded man."
It will show you to what an extent the iron had entered into my soul when I say that this was the first time I had given a thought to young Bingo. I suddenly remember now that he had told me he would be at Goodwood.
"He is making an inflammatory speech at this very moment, specifically directed at me. Come, where that crowd is."
He lugged me along, and by using his weight scientifically, got us into the front rank.
"Look, listen."
Young Bingo was certainly tearing off some ripe stuff. Inspired by the agony of having put his little all on a steamer that hadn't finished in the first six, he was fairly letting himself go on the subject of the blackness of the hearts of plutocratic owners, who allowed a trusting public to imagine a horse was the real goods, when it couldn't trot the length of its stable without getting its legs crossed and sitting down to rest. He then went on to draw what I'm bound to say was a most moving picture of the ruin of a working man's home due to this dishonesty. He showed us the working man, all optimism and simple trust, believing every word he read in the papers about Ocean Breeze's form, depriving his wife and children of food in order to back the brute, going without beer so as to be able to cram an extra bob on, robbing the baby's money box with a hatpin on the eve of the race, and finally getting let down with a thud. Dashed impressive it was. I could see old Robotham nodding his head gently, while poor old Butt glowered at the speaker with ill-concealed jealousy. The audience ate it.
"But what does Lord Bittlesham care?" shouted Bingo. "If the poor working man loses his hard-earned savings! I tell you, friends and comrades, you may talk, and you may argue, and you may cheer, and you may pass resolutions, but what you need is action. Action! The world won't be a fit place for honest men to live in till the blood of Lord Bittlesham and his kind flows in rivers down the gutters of Park Lane."
Roars of approval from the populace, most of whom, I suppose, had had their little bit on blighted Ocean Breeze, and were feeling it deeply. Old Bittlesham bounded over to a large, sad policeman, who was watching the proceedings, and appeared to be urging him to rally round. The policeman pulled at his mustache and smiled gently,
but that was as far as he seemed inclined to go. And old Bittlesham came back to me, puffing not a little.
"It's monstrous! The man definitely threatens my personal safety, and that policeman declines to interfere. Said it was just talk. Talk! It's monstrous!"
"Absolutely," I said, but I can't say it seemed to cheer him up much. Comrade Butt had taken the center of the stage now. He had a voice like the last trump, and you could hear every word he said, but somehow he didn't seem to be clicking. I suppose the fact was he was too impersonal, if that's the word I want. After Bingo's speech, the audience was in the mood for something a good deal snappier than just general marks about the cause. They had started to heckle the poor blighter pretty freely when he stopped in the middle of a sentence, and I saw that he was staring at old Bittlesham. The crowd thought he had dried up.
"Suck a lozenge!" shouted someone.
Comrade Butt pulled himself together with a jerk, and even from where I stood I could see the nasty gleam in his eye.
"Ah!" he yelled. "You may mock, comrades. You may jeer and sneer, and you may scoff. But let me tell you, the movement is spreading every day and every hour. Yes, even amongst the so-called upper classes it's spreading. Perhaps you'll believe me when I tell you that here today, on this very spot, we have in our little band one of our most earnest workers, the nephew of that very Lord Bittlesham whose name you were hooting but a moment ago."
And before poor old Bingo had a notion of what was up, he had reached out a hand and grabbed the beard. It came off all in one piece. And, wet as Bingo's speech had gone, it was simply nothing compared with the hit made by this bit of business. I heard old Bittlesham give one short, sharp snort of amazement at my side, and then any remarks he might have made were drowned in thunders of applause. I'm bound to say that in this crisis young Bingo acted with a good deal of decision and character. To grab Comrade Butt by the neck and try to twist his head off was with him the work of a moment. But before he could get any results, the sad policeman, brightening up like magic, had charged in, and the next minute he was shoving his way back through the crowd, with Bingo in his right hand and Comrade Butt in his left.
"Let me pass, sir, please," he said civilly as he came up against old Bittlesham, who was blocking the gangway. "Eh?" said old Bittlesham, still dazed.
At the sound of his voice, young Bingo looked up quickly from under the shadow of the policeman's right hand, and as he did so, all the stuffing seemed to go out of him with a rush. For an instant he drooped like a bally lily, and then shuffled brokenly on. His air was the air of a man who has got it in the neck properly. Sometimes, when Jeeves has brought in my morning tea and shoved it on the table beside my bed, he drifts silently from the room and leaves me to go to it. At other times he sort of shimmies respectfully in the middle of the carpet, and then I know that he wants a word or two. On the day after I'd got back from Goodwood, I was lying on my back, staring at the ceiling, when I noticed that he was still in my midst.
"Oh, hello," I said. "Yes?"
"Mr. Little had called early in the morning, sir."
"Oh, by Jove, what? Did he tell you about what happened?"
"Yes, sir. It was in connection with that he wished to see you. He proposes to retire to the country and remain there for some little while."
"Dash sensible."
"That was my opinion also, sir.
There was, however, a slight financial difficulty to be overcome. I took the liberty of advancing him £10 on your behalf to meet current expenses. I trust that meets with your approval, sir?"
"Oh, of course. Take a tenner off the dressing table."
"Very good, sir."
"Jeeves," I said.
"Sir?"
"What beats me is how the dickens the thing happened. I mean, how did the chappy Butt ever get to know who he was?"
Jeeves coughed.
"There, sir, I fear I may have been somewhat to blame."
"You? How?"
"I fear I may carelessly have disclosed Mr. Little's identity to Mr. Butt on the occasion when I had that conversation with him."
I sat up. "What?"
"Indeed, now that I recall the incident, sir, I distinctly remember saying that Mr. Little's work for the cause really seemed to me to deserve something in the nature of public recognition. I greatly regret having been the means of bringing about a temporary estrangement between Mr. Little and his lordship.
and I'm afraid there is another aspect to the matter. I am also responsible for the breaking off of relations between Mr. Little and the young lady who came to tea here." I sat up again. It's a rummy thing, but the silver lining had absolutely escaped my notice till then. "Do you mean to say it's off?" "Completely, sir. I gathered from Mr. Little's remarks that his hopes in the direction may now be looked on as definitely quenched. If there were no other obstacle, the young lady's father, I am informed by Mr. Little, now regards him as a spy and a deceiver." "Well, I'm dashed." "I appear inadvertently to have caused much trouble, sir." "Jeeves," I said.
"Sir?"
"How much money is there on the dressing-table?"
"In addition to the 10-pound note which you instructed me to take, sir, there are 2 5-pound notes, 3 1-pounds, 10 shillings, 2 half-crowns, 1 florin, 4 shillings, 6 pence, and 1/2-penny, sir."
"Collar it all," I said. "You've earned it."
End of chapter 12. Chapter 13 of The Inimitable Jeeves. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. The Inimitable Jeeves by P. G. Woodhouse. Chapter 13. The Great Sermon Handicap. After Goodwood's over, I generally find that I get a bit restless. I'm not much of a lad for the birds and the trees and the great open spaces, as a rule, but there's no doubt that London's not at its best in August, and rather tends to give me the pip and make me think of popping down into the country till things have bucked up a trifle. London, about a couple of weeks after that spectacular finish of young Bingo's, which I've just been telling you about, was empty and smelled of burning asphalt. All my pals were away, most of the theatres were shut, and they were taking up Piccadilly in large spadefuls. It was most infernally hot. As I sat in the old flat one night, trying to muster up energy enough to go to bed, I felt I couldn't stand it much longer. And when Jeeves came in with the tissue restorers on a tray, I put the thing to him squarely. "Jeeves," I said, wiping the brow and gasping like a stranded goldfish, "it's beastly hot."
"The weather is oppressive, sir."
"Not all the soda, Jeeves."
"No, sir."
"I think we've had about enough of the metrop for the time being, and require a change. Shift ho, I think, Jeeves, what?"
"Just as you say, sir. There is a letter on the tray, sir."
"By Jove, Jeeves, that was practically poetry. Rhymed, did you notice?" I opened the letter. "I say, this is rather extraordinary."
"Sir?"
"You know Twing Hall?"
"Yes, sir."
"Well, Mr. Little is there."
"Indeed, sir."
"Absolutely in the flesh. He's had to take another of those tutoring jobs." After that fearful mix-up at Goodwood, when young Bingo Little, a broken man, had touched me for a tenner and whizzed silently off into the unknown, I had been all over the place, asking mutual friends if they had heard anything of him, but nobody had. And all the time he had been at Twing Hall. Rummy. And I'll tell you why it was rummy. Twing Hall belongs to old Lord Wick Hammersley, a great pal of my governor's when he was alive, and I have a standing invitation to pop down there when I like. I generally put in a week or two sometime in the summer, and I was thinking of going there before I read the letter. And what's more, Jeeves, my cousin Claude and my cousin Eustace, you remember them?"
"Very vividly, sir."
"Well, they're down there, too, reading for some exam or other with the vicar. I used to read with him myself at one time. He's known far and wide as a pretty hot coach for those of fairly feeble intellect. Well, when I tell you he got me through Smalls, you'll gather that he's a bit of a hummer. I call this most extraordinary." I read the letter again. It was from Eustace. Claude and Eustace are twins, and more or less generally admitted to be the curse of the human race. The Vicarage, Twing Gloss. "Dear Bertie, do you want to make a bit of money? I hear you had a bad Goodwood, so you probably do. Well, come down here quick and get in on the biggest sporting event of the season. I'll explain when I see you, but you can take it from me, it's all right.
Claude and I are with a reading party at old Heppenstall's. There are 9 of us, not counting your pal Bingo Little, who is tutoring the kid up at the hall. Don't miss this golden opportunity, which may never occur again. Come and join us. Yours, Eustace.
I handed this to Jeeves. He studied it thoughtfully.
What do you make of it? A rummy communication, what?
Very high-spirited young gentlemen, sir, Mr. Claude and Mr. Eustace. Up to some game, I should be disposed to imagine.
Yes, but what game do you think?
It is impossible to say, sir. Did you observe that the letter continues over the page?
Eh, what?
I grabbed the thing. This was what was on the other side of the last page. Sermon handicap. Runners and betting. Probable starters. Reverend Joseph Tucker. Badgewick. Scratch. Reverend Leonard Starkey. Stapleton. Scratch. Reverend Alexander Jones. Upper Bingley. Receives 3 minutes. Reverend W. Dix. Little Clickton in the Wold. Receives 5 minutes. Reverend Francis Heppenstall, Tweeng, receives 8 minutes. Reverend Cuthbert Dibble, Bosted Parva, receives 9 minutes. Reverend Arlo Huff, Bosted Magna, receives 9 minutes. Reverend J.J. Roberts, Fail by the Water, receives 10 minutes. Reverend G. Hayward, Lower Bingley, receives 12 minutes. Reverend James Bates, Gander by the Hill, receives 15 minutes. The above have arrived. Prices. 5-2, Tucker, Starkey. 3-1, Jones. 9-2, Dix. 6-1, Heppenstall, Dibble, Huff. 100-8, any other.
It baffled me.
Do you understand it, Jeeves?
No, sir.
Well, I think we ought to have a look into it anyway, what?
Undoubtedly, sir.
Righto, then. Pack our spare dicky and a toothbrush and a neat brown paper parcel, send a wire to Lord Wick Hammersley to say we're coming, and buy 2 tickets on the 5:10 at Paddington tomorrow. The 5:10 was late as usual, and everybody was dressing for dinner when I arrived at the hall. It was only by getting into my evening things in record time and taking the stairs to the dining room in a couple of bounds that I managed to dead heat with the soup. I slid into the vacant chair and found that I was sitting next to old Wick Hammersley's youngest daughter, Cynthia. "Oh, hello, old thing," I said. "Great pals we've always been. In fact, there was a time when I had an idea I was in love with Cynthia. However, it blew over. A dashed pretty and lively and attractive girl, mind you, but full of ideals and all that. I may be wronging her, but I have an idea that she's the sort of girl who would want a fellow to carve out a career and what not. I know I've heard her speak favorably of Napoleon. So what with one thing and another, the jolly old frenzy sort of petered out, and now we're just pals. I think she's a topper, and she thinks me next door to a loony, so everything's nice and matey.
Well, Bertie, so you've arrived.
Oh, yes, I've arrived. Yes, here I am.
I say, I seem to have plunged into the middle of quite a young dinner party. Who are all these coves?
Oh, just people from round about. You know most of them. You remember Colonel Willis and the Spencers?
Of course, yes.
And there's old Heppenstall. Who's the other clergyman next to Mrs. Spencer?
Mr. Hayward, from Lower Bingley.
What an amazing lot of clergymen there are around here. Why, there's another next to Mrs. Willis.
That's Mr. Bates, Mr. Heppenstall's nephew. He's an assistant master at Eton. He's down here during the summer holidays, acting as locum tenens for Mr. Spedigue, the rector of Gandle-by-the-Hill.
I thought I knew his face. He was in his 4th year at Oxford when I was a fresher. Rather a blood. Got his rowing blue and all that.
I took another look round the table and spotted young Bingo.
"Ah, there he is," I said. "There's the old egg."
"There's who?"
"Young Bingo Little. Great pal of mine. He's tutoring your brother, you know."
"Good gracious. Is he a friend of yours?"
"Rather. Known him all my life."
"Then tell me, Bertie, is he at all weak in the head?"
"Weak in the head?"
"I don't mean simply because he's a friend of yours, but he's so strange in his manner."
"How do you mean?"
"Well,
He keeps looking at me so oddly.
Oddly? How?
Give an imitation. I can't in front of all these people.
Yes, you can. I'll hold my napkin up.
All right, then. Quick. There.
Considering that she had only about a second and a half to do it in, I must say it was a jolly fine exhibition. She opened her mouth and eyes pretty wide and let her jaw drop sideways, and managed to look so like a dyspeptic calf that I recognized the symptoms immediately.
"Oh, that's all right," I said. "No need to be alarmed. He's simply in love with you."
"In love with me? Don't be absurd."
"My dear old thing, you don't know young Bingo. He can fall in love with anybody."
"Thank you. Oh, I didn't mean it like that, you know. I don't wonder at his taking to you. Why, I was in love with you myself once."
"Once? Ah, and all that remains now are the cold ashes. This isn't one of your tactful evenings, Bertie."
"Well, my dear sweet thing, dash it all, considering that you gave me the bird and nearly laughed yourself into a permanent state of hiccoughs when I asked you—"
"Oh, I'm not reproaching you. No doubt there were faults on both sides. He's very good-looking, isn't he?"
"Good-looking? Bingo? Bingo, good-looking?
No, I say, come now, really."
"I mean, compared with some people," said Cynthia.
Some time after this, Lady Wickhammersley gave the signal for the females of the species to leg it, and they duly stampeded. I didn't get a chance of talking to young Bingo when they'd gone, and later in the drawing-room he didn't show up. I found him eventually in his room, lying on the bed with his feet on the rail, smoking a tufa. There was a notebook on the counterpane beside him.
"Hello, old Scream," I said.
"Hello, Bertie," he replied, in what seemed to me rather a moody, distrait sort of manner.
"Rummy finding you down here. I take it your uncle cut off your allowance after that Goodwood binge, and you had to take this tutoring job to keep the wolf from the door?"
"Correct," said young Bingo tersely.
"Well, you might have let your pals know where you were."
He frowned darkly.
"I didn't want them to know where I was. I wanted to creep away and hide myself. I've been through a bad time, Bertie, these last weeks. The sun ceased to shine."
"That's curious. We've had gorgeous weather in London."
"The birds ceased to sing."
"What birds?"
"What the devil does it matter what birds?" said young Bingo with some asperity. "Any birds. The birds round about here. You don't expect me to specify them by their pet names, do you? I tell you, Bertie, it hit me hard at first, very hard."
"What hit you?"
"I simply couldn't follow the blighter.
Charlotte's calculated callousness."
"Oh, ah.
I've seen poor old Bingo through so many unsuccessful love affairs that I'd almost forgotten there was a girl mixed up with that Goodwood business. Of course, Charlotte Corday Robotham. And she had given him the raspberry, I remembered, and gone off with Comrade Butt. I went through torments. Recently, however, I've, bucked up a bit. Tell me, Bertie, what are you doing down here? I didn't know you knew these people."
"Me? Why, I've known them since I was a kid."
Young Bingo put his feet down with a thud.
"Do you mean to say you've known Lady Cynthia all that time?"
"Rather. She can't have been seven when I met her first."
"Good Lord," said young Bingo.
He looked at me for the first time as though I amounted to something, and swallowed a mouthful of smoke the wrong way.
"I love that girl, Bertie," he went on when he'd finished coughing.
"Yes, nice girl, of course."
He eyed me with pretty deep loathing.
"Don't speak of her in that horrible casual way. She's an angel, an angel."
"Was she talking about me at all at dinner, Bertie?"
"Oh, yes."
"What did she say?"
"I remember one thing. She said she thought you good-looking."
Young Bingo closed his eyes in a sort of ecstasy. Then he picked up the notebook.
"Pop off now, old man. There's a good chap," he said in a hushed, faraway voice. "I've got a bit of writing to do."
"Writing?"
"Poetry, if you must know. I wish the dickens," said young Bingo, not without some bitterness, "that she'd been christened something except Cynthia.
There isn't a damn word in the language it rhymes with.
Ye gods, how I could have spread myself if she had only been called Jane.
Bright and early next morning, as I lay in bed blinking at the sunlight on the dressing table and wondering when Jeeves was going to show up with a cup of tea, a heavy weight descended on my toes, and the voice of young Bingo polluted the air. The blighter had apparently risen with the lark.
"Leave me," I said. "I would be alone. I can't see anybody till I've had my tea."
"When Cynthia smiles," said young Bingo, "the skies are blue. The world takes on a roseate hue. Birds in the garden trill and sing, and joy is king of everything when Cynthia smiles."
He coughed, changing gears.
"When Cynthia frowns, what the devil are you talking about?"
"I'm reading you my poem, the one I wrote to Cynthia last night. I'll go on, shall I?"
"No."
"No?
No, I haven't had my tea."
At this moment, Jeeves came in with the good old beverage, and I sprang on it with a glad cry. After a couple of sips, things looked a bit brighter. Even young Bingo didn't offend the eye to quite such an extent. By the time I'd finished the first cup, I was a new man, so much so that I not only permitted but encouraged the poor fish to read the rest of the bally thing, and even went so far as to criticize the scansion of the fourth line of the fifth verse. We were still arguing the point when the door burst open and in blew Claude and Eustace. One of the things which discourage me about rural life is the frightful earliness with which events begin to break loose. I've stayed at places in the country where they've jerked me out of the dreamless at about 6:30 to go for a jolly swim in the lake. At Twing, thank heaven, they know me and let me breakfast in bed. The twins seemed pleased to see me.
"Good old Bertie," said Claude.
"Stout fellow," said Eustace.
"The Rev told us you'd arrived. I thought that letter of mine would fetch you."
"You can always bank on Bertie," said Claude. "A sportsman to the fingertips.
Well, has Bingo told you about it?"
"Not a word. He's been—"
"We've been talking," said Bingo hastily, "of other matters."
Claude pinched the last slice of thin bread and butter, and Eustace poured himself out a cup of tea.
"It's like this, Bertie," said Eustace, settling down cozily. "As I told you in my letter, there are nine of us marooned in this desert spot, reading with old Heppenstall. Well, of course, nothing is jollier than sweating up the classics when it's 100 in the shade, but there does come a time when you begin to feel the need of a little relaxation. And by Jove, there are absolutely no facilities for relaxation in this place whatever. And then Steggles got this idea. Steggles is one of our reading party, and between ourselves, rather a worm as a general thing. Still, you have to give him credit for getting this idea."
"What idea?"
"Well, you know how many parsons there are round about here. There are about a dozen hamlets within a radius of 6 miles, and each hamlet has a church, and each church has a parson, and each parson preaches a sermon every Sunday. Tomorrow week, Sunday the 23rd, we're running off the great sermon handicap. Steggles is making the book. Each parson is to be clocked by a reliable steward of the course, and the one that preaches the longest sermon wins. Did you study the race card I sent you?"
I couldn't understand what it was all about.
"Why, you chump, it gives the handicaps and the current odds on each starter. I've got another one here in case you've lost yours. Take a careful look at it. It gives you the thing in a nutshell. Jeeves, old son, do you want a sporting flutter?"
"Sir," said Jeeves, who had just meandered in with my breakfast.
Claude explained the scheme. Amazing the way Jeeves grasped it right off, but he merely smiled in a paternal sort of way.
"Thank you, sir, I think not."
"Well, you're with us, Bertie, aren't you?" said Claude, sneaking a roll and a slice of bacon. "Have you studied that card? Well, tell me, does anything strike you about it?"
"Of course it did. It had struck me the moment I looked at it."
"Why, it's a sitter for old Heppenstall," I said. "He's got the event sewed up in a parcel. There isn't a parson in the land who could give him 8 minutes. Your pal Steggles must be an ass, giving him a handicap like that.
Why, in the days when I was with him, old Heppenstall never used to preach under half an hour, and there was one sermon of his on brotherly love which lasted 45 minutes if it lasted a second. Has he lost his vim lately, or what is it?"
"Not a bit of it," said Eustace.
"Tell him what happened, Claude."
"Why," said Claude, "the first Sunday we were here, we all went to Twing Church, and old Heppenstall preached a sermon that was well under 20 minutes. This is what happened. Steggles didn't notice it, and the Rev didn't notice it himself, but Eustace and I both spotted that he had dropped a chunk of at least half a dozen pages out of his sermon case as he was walking up to the pulpit. He sort of flickered when he got to the gap in the manuscript, but carried on all right, and Steggles went away with the impression that 20 minutes or a bit under was his usual form. The next Sunday we heard Tucker and Starkey, and they both went well over the 35 minutes, so Steggles arranged the handicapping as you see on the card. You must come into this, Bertie. You see, the trouble is that I haven't a bean, and Eustace hasn't a bean, and Bingo Little hasn't a bean, so you'll have to finance the syndicate.
Don't weaken. It's just putting money in all our pockets.
Well, we'll have to be getting back now. Think the thing over, and phone me later in the day. And if you let us down, Bertie, may a cousin's curse. Come on, Claude, old thing."
The more I studied the scheme, the better it looked.
"How about it, Jeeves?" I said.
Jeeves smiled gently and drifted out.
"Jeeves has no sporting blood," said Bingo.
"Well, I have. I'm coming into this. Claude's quite right. It's like finding money by the wayside."
"Good man," said Bingo.
"Now I can see daylight. Say I have a tenner on Heppenstall and Kopp. That'll give me a bit in hand to bank Pink Pill with in the 2 o'clock at Gatwick the week after next. Cop on that, put the pile on Muskrat for the 1:30 at Lewes, and there I am with a nice little sum to take to Alexandra Park on September the 10th, when I've got a tip straight from the stable."
It sounded like a bit out of Smiles's self-help.
"And then," said young Bingo, "I'll be in a position to go to my uncle and beard him in his lair somewhat. He's quite a bit of a snob, you know, and when he hears that I'm going to marry the daughter of an earl—" "I say, old man," I couldn't help saying, "aren't you looking ahead rather far?"
"Oh, that's all right. It's true nothing's actually settled yet, but she practically told me the other day she was fond of me."
"What?"
"Well, she said that the sort of man she liked was the self-reliant, manly man with strength, good looks, character, ambition, and initiative."
"Leave me, laddie," I said. "Leave me to my fried egg."
Directly I got up, I went to the phone, snatched Eustace away from his morning's work, and instructed him to put a tenner on the Twing Flyer at current odds for each of the syndicate. And after lunch, Eustace rang me up to say that he had done business at a snappy 7-1, the odds having lengthened owing to a rumor in knowledgeable circles that the Rev was subject to hay fever and was taking big chances strolling in the paddock behind the vicarage in the early mornings. And it was dashed lucky, I thought, next day, that we had managed to get the money on in time, for on the Sunday morning old Heppenstall fairly took the bit between his teeth and gave us 36 solid minutes on certain popular superstitions. I was sitting next to Steggles in the pew, and I saw him blench visibly. He was a little rat-faced fellow, with shifty eyes and a suspicious nature. The first thing he did when we emerged into the open air was to announce formally that anyone who fancied the Rev could now be accommodated at 7:55 on, and he added, in a rather nasty manner, that if he had his way, this sort of in-and-out running would be brought to the attention of the Jockey Club, but that he supposed that there was nothing to be done about it. This ruinous price checked the punters at once, and there was little money in sight. And so matters stood till just after lunch on Tuesday afternoon, when, as I was strolling up and down in front of the house with a cigarette, Claude and Eustace came bursting up the drive on bicycles, dripping with momentous news.
"Bertie," said Claude, deeply agitated, "unless we take immediate action and do a bit of quick thinking, we're in the cart."
"What's the matter?"
"G. Haywood's the matter," said Eustace morosely. "The Lower Bingley starter."
"We never even considered him," said Claude.
"Somehow or other he got overlooked. It's always the way.
Steggles overlooked him. We all overlooked him. But Eustace and I happened by the merest fluke to be riding through Lower Bingley this morning, and there was a wedding on at the church, and it suddenly struck us that it wouldn't be a bad move to get a line on G. Haywood's form, in case he might be a dark horse.
"And it was jolly lucky we did," said Eustace.
He delivered an address of 26 minutes by Claude's stopwatch. At a village wedding, mark you. What'll he do when he really extends himself?
"There's only one thing to be done, Bertie," said Claude. "You must spring some more funds so that we can hedge on Haywood and save ourselves."
"But, well, it's the only way out."
"But I say, you know, I hate the idea of all that money we put on Heppenstall being chucked away."
"What else can you suggest? You don't suppose the Rev can give this absolute marvel a handicap and win, do you?"
"I've got it," I said.
"What?"
"I see a way by which we can make it safe for our nominee. I'll pop over this afternoon and ask him as a personal favor to preach that sermon of his on brotherly love on Sunday."
Claude and Eustace looked at each other, like those chappies in the poem with a wild surmise.
"It's a scheme," said Claude. "A jolly brainy scheme," said Eustace. "I didn't think you had it in you, Bertie."
"But even so," said Claude, "fizzer as that sermon no doubt is, will it be good enough in the face of a 4-minute handicap?"
"Rather," I said.
"When I told you it lasted 45 minutes, I was probably understating it. I should call it, from my recollection of the thing, nearer 50.
"Then carry on," said Claude.
I toddled over in the evening and fixed the thing up. Old Heppenstall was most decent about the whole affair. He seemed pleased and touched that I should have remembered the sermon all these years, and said he had once or twice had an idea of preaching it again, only it had seemed to him, on reflection, that it was perhaps a trifle long for a rustic congregation.
"And in these restless times, my dear Wooster," he said, "I fear that brevity in the pulpit is becoming more and more desiderated by even the bucolic churchgoer, who one might have supposed would be less afflicted with the spirit of hurry and impatience than his metropolitan brother. I have had many arguments on the subject with my nephew, young Bates, who is taking my old friend Spedigue's cure over at Gandle-by-the-Hill. His view is that a sermon nowadays should be a bright, brisk, straight-from-the-shoulder address, never lasting more than 10 or 12 minutes."
"Long?" I said. "Why, my goodness! You don't call that brotherly love sermon of yours long, do you?"
"It takes fully 50 minutes to deliver."
"Surely not."
"Your incredulity, my dear Wooster, is extremely flattering. Far more flattering, of course, than I deserve. Nevertheless, the facts are as I have stated. You are sure that I would not be well advised to make certain excisions and eliminations? You do not think it would be a good thing to cut, to prune? I might, for example, delete the rather exhaustive excursus into the family life of the early Assyrians."
"Don't touch a word of it, or you'll spoil the whole thing," I said earnestly.
"I am delighted to hear you say so, and I shall preach the sermon without fail next Sunday morning."
What I have always said, and what I always shall say, is that this anti-post betting is a mistake, an error, and a mug's game. You never can tell what's going to happen. If fellows would only stick to the good old S.P., there would be fewer young men go wrong. I'd hardly finished my breakfast on the Saturday morning when Jeeves came to my bedside to say that Eustace wanted me on the telephone.
"Good Lord, Jeeves, what's the matter, do you think?"
I'm bound to say I was beginning to get a bit jumpy by this time.
"Mr. Eustace did not confide in me, sir."
"Has he got the wind up?"
"Somewhat vertically, sir, to judge by his voice."
"Do you know what I think, Jeeves? Something's gone wrong with the favourite."
"Which is the favourite, sir?"
"Mr. Heppenstall. He's gone to odds on. He was intending to preach a sermon on brotherly love which would have brought him home by lengths. I wonder if anything's happened to him."
"You could ascertain, sir, by speaking to Mr. Eustace on the telephone. He is holding the wire."
"By Jove, yes!" I shoved on a dressing gown and flew downstairs like a mighty rushing wind.
The moment I heard Eustace's voice, I knew we were for it. It had a croak of agony in it.
"Bertie?"
"Here I am."
"Deuce of a time you've been. Bertie, we're sunk. The favorite's blown up."
"No."
"Yes. Coughing in his stable all last night."
"What?"
"Absolutely. Hay fever."
"Oh, my sainted aunt."
"The doctor is with him now, and it's only a question of minutes before he's officially scratched. That means the curate will show up at the post instead, and he's no good at all. He is being offered at 106, and no takers. What shall we do?"
I had to grapple with the thing for a moment in silence.
"Eustace? Hello? What can you get on G. Haywood?"
"Only 4-1 now. I think there's been a leak, and Steggles has heard something.
The odds shortened late last night in a significant manner.
Well, 4-1 will clear us. Put another fiver all round on G. Haywood for the syndicate. That'll bring us out on the right side of the ledger. If he wins."
"What do you mean? I thought you considered him a cert bar Heppenstall."
"I'm beginning to wonder," said Eustace gloomily, "if there's such a thing as a cert in this world. I'm told the Rev. Joseph Tucker did an extraordinary fine trial gallop at Mother's meeting over at Badgwick yesterday. However, it seems our only chance. So long."
Not being one of the official stewards, I had my choice of churches next morning, and naturally I didn't hesitate. The only drawback to going to Lower Bingley was that it was 10 miles away, which meant an early start, but I borrowed a bicycle from one of the grooms and tooled off. I had only Eustace's word for it that G. Haywood was such a stayer, and it might have been that he had showed too flattering form at that wedding where the twins had heard him preach. But any misgivings I may have had disappeared the moment he got into the pulpit. Eustace had been right. The man was a trier. He was a tall, rangy-looking greybeard, and he went off from the start with a nice, easy action, pausing and clearing his throat at the end of each sentence, and it wasn't 5 minutes before I realized that here was the winner. His habit of stopping dead and looking round the church at intervals was worth minutes to us, and in the home stretch we gained no little advantage owing to his dropping his pince-nez and having to grope for them. At the 20-minute mark he had merely settled down. 25 minutes saw him growing strong, and when he finally finished with a good burst, the clock showed 35 minutes 14 seconds. With the handicap which he had been given, this seemed to me to make the event easy for him, and it was with much bonhomie and goodwill to all men that I hopped onto the old bike and started back to the hall for lunch. Bingo was talking on the phone when I arrived.
"Fine, splendid, topping," he was saying.
"Eh? Oh, we needn't worry about him."
"Righto, I'll tell Bertie."
He hung up the receiver and caught sight of me.
"Oh, hello, Bertie. I was just talking to Eustace." "It's all right, old man."
"The report from Lower Bingley has just got in. G. Haywood romps home."
"I knew he would. I've just come from there."
"Oh, were you there?"
"I went to Badgwick. Tucker ran a splendid race, but the handicap was too much for him. Starkey had a sore throat and was nowhere. Roberts, by fail by the water, ran third."
"Good old G. Haywood," said Bingo affectionately, and we strolled out onto the terrace.
"Are all the returns in, then?" I asked.
"All except Gandle by the Hill. But we needn't worry about Bates. He never had a chance. By the way, poor old Jeeves loses his tenor. Silly ass."
"Jeeves? How do you mean?"
"He came to me this morning, just after you had left, and asked me to put a tenor on Bates for him. I told him he was a chump and begged him not to throw his money away, but he would do it."
"I beg your pardon, sir. This note arrived for you just after you had left the house this morning."
Jeeves had materialized from nowhere and was standing at my elbow.
"Eh? What? Note?"
"The Reverend Mr. Heppenstall's butler brought it over from the vicarage, sir. It came too late to be delivered to you at the moment." Young Bingo was talking to Jeeves like a father on the subject of betting against the form book. The yell I gave made him bite his tongue in the middle of a sentence.
"What the dickens is the matter?" he asked, not a little peeved.
"We're dished.
Listen to this."
I read him the note.
"The Vicarage, Tween Gloss.
My dear Wooster, as you may have heard, circumstances over which I have no control will prevent my preaching the sermon on brotherly love for which you had made such a flattering request. I am unwilling, however, that you shall be disappointed, so if you will attend divine service at Gandle-by-the-Hill this morning, you will hear my sermon preached by young Bates, my nephew. I have lent him the manuscript at his urgent desire, for between ourselves there are wheels within wheels. My nephew is one of the candidates for the headmastership of a well-known public school, and the choice has narrowed down between him and one rival. Late yesterday evening, James received private information that the head of the board of governors of the school proposed to sit under him this Sunday in order to judge the merits of his preaching, a most important item in swaying the board's choice. I acceded to his plea that I lend him my sermon on brotherly love, of which, like you, he apparently retains a vivid recollection. It would have been too late for him to compose a sermon of suitable length in place of the brief address which, mistakenly in my opinion, he had designed to deliver to his rustic flock, and I wished to help the boy. Trusting that his preaching of the sermon will supply you with as pleasant memories as you say you have of mine, I remain, cordially yours, F. Heppenstall. P.S. The hay fever has rendered my eyes unpleasantly weak for the time being, so I am dictating this letter to my butler, Brookfield, who will convey it to you. I don't know when I've experienced a more massive silence than the one that followed my reading of this cheery epistle. Young Bingo gulped once or twice, and practically every known emotion came and went on his face. Jeeves coughed one soft, low, gentle cough, like a sheep with a blade of grass stuck in its throat, and then stood gazing serenely at the landscape. Finally, young Bingo spoke.
"Great Scott!" he whispered hoarsely. "An S.P. job!"
"I believe that is the technical term, sir," said Jeeves.
"So, you had inside information, dash it!" said young Bingo.
"Why, yes, sir," said Jeeves. "Brookfield happened to mention the contents of the note to me when he brought it. We are old friends." Bingo registered grief, anguish, rage, despair, and resentment.
"Well, all I can say," he cried, "is that it's a bit thick. Preaching another man's sermon? Do you call that honest? Do you call that playing the game?"
"Well, my dear old thing," I said, "be fair. It's quite within the rules. Clergymen do it all the time. They aren't expected always to make up the sermons they preach."
Jeeves coughed again and fixed me with an expressionless eye.
"And in the prison case, sir, if I may be permitted to take the liberty of making the observation, I think we should make allowances. We should remember that the securing of this headmastership meant everything to the young couple."
"Young couple? What young couple?"
"The Reverend James Bates, sir, and Lady Cynthia. I am informed by your ladyship's maid that they have been engaged to be married for some weeks, provisionally, so to speak. And his lordship made his consent conditional on Mr. Bates securing a really important and remunerative position."
Young Bingo turned a light green.
"Engaged to be married?"
"Yes, sir." There was a silence.
"I think I'll go for a walk," said Bingo.
"But, my dear old thing," I said, "it's just lunchtime. The gong will be going any minute now."
"I don't want any lunch," said Bingo. End of chapter 13.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, for thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.